What's up, Dialed fam? Welcome to episode 183 of the Dialed Health Podcast. My name is Derek Teal. I'm the owner and head coach here at dialedhealth.com, which is strength training for cyclists. And on today's episode, I sit down with Mike Cohen, whose story will blow you away. In fact, my intention of doing this interview was really to do an active live coaching call and talk about how he's going to implement strength training to train for this 1,000-plus-mile ride that he's doing October 1st. But that ride represents the 20-year anniversary of when he was diagnosed with cancer. And as you'll hear, he's gone on to not only beat cancer, but have a heart transplant and continue ultracycling. So we get into the story, and there was too much that we had to dive into. So that's really where the focus is. It's crazy inspirational. He's very articulate in how he's able to describe what was happening to him, and even how it relates to things I've been going through and things other people go through as well. And at the end, we do get on some training and talk about what he's going to do to implement strength training. But just wanted to prepare you for this awesome conversation and wanted to shout out to all the Dialed fam and thank you guys for the support. I'm recovering. I'm making progress. There have been some setbacks, but mentally, I feel like I'm in the best place I've been. And I don't feel pressured by a timeline that I've made in my own head anymore. I know that this is just going to take whatever amount of time that it takes, and that more willpower really isn't going to speed up the healing, because you guys already know I'm going to do everything I can to heal as fast as possible. And if anything, I'm going to overdo it, which I've already kind of tiptoed in a little. So the mindset is around really getting as healthy as possible and not focusing on regaining my fitness as fast as possible. And so, yeah, just feeling very good. So thanks for the prayers. Thanks for the support. I hope you guys are getting after it, integrating your strength workouts as you move into summer and hopefully crushing your A events. But without further ado, let's dive into this episode. All right, Mike, I'm sorry for being late on this podcast, but I was out riding. I overshot my mileage and I overestimated how fast I'd be riding. I keep doing that.
It's a good problem to have, man.
Yeah, that's true.
I love it.
And it was funny because I was actually getting a little stressed riding home, because right now the shower process is a little bit longer. I have this wound that broke open. I'm adding extra bandages. There's cleaning this. There's adding the waterproof bandage to this. And it's those little steps that they make you so frustrated, because you're like, gosh, if I wasn't dealing with this, I'd be in and out and I'd be ready. And I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but that's why I'm late for this pod.
Hey, man. I totally remember that process of trying to find the best, let's call it household type of products outside of medical Tagaderms and all those, you know, really, really sticky products that you use in specifically to keep things waterproof. I mean, me, like what I remember specifically is when I was living with the LVAD, which is a left ventricle assist device that was installed in my heart due to a heart clot, a blood clot that I had to wrap myself in saran wrap before every shower. So I understand not looking forward to the showers, but also that feeling of the water hitting you after, like for me, it was cardiac rehab, for you, a long ride, rehab, physical rehab, whatever it is. Like the biggest gift that a person could have after any sort of activity is just cool water just refreshing you. Like that feeling is
so true.
There's nothing, I'm sure you could even, you know, even speak for that. Like, you know, when you were able to take your first shower after your, you know, after your crash, it doesn't get any better than that. You realize like how far and how important simple, tiny little things really are, you know?
Dude, that is so true. I think it was 3 weeks after my surgeries and getting hit that I took the first shower. And I had so much skin coming off my body. I mean, I remember having casts when I was younger.
Yeah.
And like you get an arm cast and then it comes off and you're just rubbing the skin off.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember driving home after getting a cast off of my arm one time, and I stuck my arm out the window of the car while one of my parents was driving.
Coming off.
I just started rubbing all the flakes off.
No, yeah, that's definitely like, there's some things that, you know, in terms of like injury, like, you know, things that we love to do. And then when you're in a position of recovery and rehabilitation, you start finding ways to find comfort in that process as well, right? Because you don't have much of a choice. You have to kind of take the process of exactly what it is, you know, step by step, day by day. And, you know, like even like the smallest things, like just not having to worry about dry skin anymore. Or in my case, I had like the little adhesive that would constantly be stuck on my skin after taking a shower, because you take it off, but then you wouldn't be able to get that wet because that's too close to the wound or too close to whatever incision you had. And, you know, yeah, it's just the little things that just make you appreciate it all. Even the process, even the recovery, even those steps to come back, I feel like it just makes you appreciate like where you are right now and how you got right here, you know?
Gosh, you're so right. I mean, I'm grateful to be talking to you today, because I think I've had a lot of mindset change in the last week, and there's been a lot of growth that I've kind of been searching for since this whole thing went down, because everyone even tells you, oh my gosh, you're never going to look at life the same. And I've kind of been approaching this recovery how I've approached everything else previously, which is like more willpower. And I realized, I was like, okay, I am motivated and I love exercise enough to where no one's going to have to motivate me to do the whatever I can, but
right.
I'm already kind of overdoing it a little bit, and I need to focus on my health being as, you know, coming back as well as possible, opposed to just regaining my fitness as fast as possible. Cause it's right. Funny, but those two things are kind of different. Like, you can focus on performance and put yourself behind just health wise. And
totally.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No. So I was just going to say, like it's so crazy how, I mean, I've been an athlete, not at this level in terms of like, you know, consistently creating crazy goals and long distances, but I've always trained. Like, I always have the mindset of training. And I've torn my hip flexor as a young kid, you know, playing baseball. I've taken cleats to the shin. I've, you know, broken bones playing basketball. I mean, traditional athletic, you know, occupational hazards, but, yeah, like the whole process of recovery, I think when it's a long recovery, when it's broken bones with surgery, whether something inserted in your body to help healing, you know, there has to be a certain synchronicity to your body recovering, but then also your mind recovering. And like, the big part of the mind recovering is learning how to accept what you can do and being okay that at this exact moment, you might not be able to produce or, you know, have a level of performance that you're used to doing because of, you know, whatever level of performance that you're used to. At the end of the day, I'll never forget it. Like, when I was waiting in the hospital for the call to get my heart transplant, my surgeon would always say to me, you know, hurry, like slow down to hurry up, or hurry up to speed to slow down. But it was such a, like the way he said it at the time was, you really have to appreciate this process now, because when the situation comes and you're ready to go back, you want to make sure you took all those steps so you don't miss anything, because you have this second chance, you have this third chance to improve something that maybe you never considered before. Maybe you never got that seriously injured, and that maybe there's a better way to get stronger. Maybe there's a better way to get stronger physically by getting your mind stronger, and vice versa. And so, you know, depending upon that condition and that athlete and that situation, if anything, like, the recovery process could be one of the most difficult, but also one of the most, you know, teaching lessons, one of the most inspirational and like impactful processes of that whole recovery is what you find, you know, what you find up here to get to everything else. That's what I've learned. And I'm still learning that, you know, I still learn every day. There's new to be learned every day.
That's so powerful, especially coming from you. In fact, you're kind of hinting at everything that you have overcome, like the heart transplant. And I know that the big reason I wanted to connect with you, besides just getting to know you better, was to help you train for this upcoming ride, which is October 1st, and it's the 20th anniversary of when you were first diagnosed with cancer. And I'd love to get a brief timeline of those major events medically that have kind of led you to this point, if you don't mind, just so people know where you're coming from. And then I would love to dive into your training from here to bridge the gap so you're prepared in October.
Sounds great. Absolutely. So it all starts, I'm 39 years old. I turned 39 this past February. This whole journey, this whole medical path started on January 18th of 2004. So I was 18 turning 19 at the time. I was going to a culinary arts school in New York City. That was my career path at the time. I was very good at cooking, very good at preparing food, and I wanted to do something with that career. And long story short, I was just walking to work one day, and I had these lumps under my throat for a couple weeks leading up to that time, and it was snowing, and so I just hocked up some phlegm, and it was covered in blood. And so that led to me being rushed to the hospital later that night in excruciating pain, you know, thinking at that time I was actually having a heart attack, when in actuality, it was my spleen that was so enlarged, I was pushing into my rib cage, and I was just in so much pain on top of whatever was going on inside of my body. And that morning after that crazy night, the confirmation was there that I was diagnosed with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Some people call it acute lymphocytic leukemia, but typically it's the cancer of the bone marrow. And in most cases, it's due to either chemical exposure or a genetic, it's direct chemical exposure or the use of immunosuppressant drugs at an early age. So that's what I was, that's what the initial diagnosis was. Prognosis looked like 2.5 years of chemotherapy. That was in different formats of pill, IV, push. I had bone marrow biopsies that I had to get regularly. I had spinal tap infusion chemotherapy appointments where instead of the chemotherapy being infused into my arms or into my hands, they would be infusing it directly into my spine, because that's actually where the cancer cells would hide. So they would have to do this for about 2 years. And then a year into treatments, I had
Can I pause you right there?
Yeah, of course.
Dude, so you're saying in the course of one day as a 18-year-old, mm-hmm. you went from I'm going to be a chef mm-hmm. to I'm going to be battling cancer for the next 2.5 years.
Yeah. Like everything that I had planned, like I had a whole plan where I was going to the Art Institute in New York City, and they wanted to do it was the beginning stages of Food Network being really popular. And so they wanted to do a show of the best teen chef of America. And I was competing, because that's actually how I got a scholarship to the culinary school I was going to. And they wanted to market that whole thing for all regional cooks all over New York City, all over that area. And yeah, so I went from having this mindset of like, I think I might have a career here, to you're not doing anything anymore. You can only focus on your treatments, and you know, we'll go from there. Like that's all that was on my plan. I was in the hospital for weeks. I did not have any choices. Every decision was at that point was had to be approved by my nurses and my oncology team at that time.
Gosh, I just can't even imagine. Did you have a lot of family support at the time? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, throughout the whole thing, through beginning to end, even to now, I have incredible support. At that time, I had my mom stay with me every night. My parents would come. I mean, my brother would come whenever he could. Because he was younger at that time. I was 18. He was 14. So it wasn't like he had access to drive. So he had to come whenever there was a chance. I had friends stopping by at all times. I was very lucky. Like I had great support throughout the whole thing.
Yeah. That's really good to hear, because. Massive and I ask because, you know, that's been such a big part of the recovery I'm dealing with, mm-hmm. but it really is just this reminder that as bad as this incident was for me, it can be so much worse. And I feel bad comparing myself to you in that way. And I'm sorry mm-hmm. to do it like that, but it really is that reminder. Cause initially in my head, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is the most extreme thing ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was obviously very sudden, like split second from like looking, literally just taking in the scenery around me to like, oh my gosh, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the process leading after that has been very hopeful in regards to recovery. There have been setbacks, but even then, things that are a lot more short term than what you're looking at. And I actually had a brother-in-law just beat bone cancer, and it was a form of leukemia. I'm not sure if it was the same one or not, but even watching him and the way he's been treating me through this, it's like, wow, I can tell that he gets what I'm going through even to another level, because the way he's been there for me has been different. And it's very interesting to see. So I'm happy to hear that. I just had to ask. So you're in that position. You're now fully focused on recovery, and then where does it go from there?
No, I mean, you brought up a really good point. I mean, so like, that's the thing. It's like, first off, never apologize as comparing, because I feel it's important for you to realize, number one, how lucky you are in your own injury, in your own situation, but then also it to ground you to be like, there's always someone worse. Even for myself, I was just going to get to that point, is like, throughout all of this stuff, throughout all this crazy stuff that I have, like, I still to this moment say, I have family that showed up. I had people that were going to come by with food and text messages and cards. Like, they could always be a worse situation. There could always be there's always someone that has it worse. But also, like you just said, like with your brother being able to treat you a certain way, I feel that when you're a survivor of any level, we have this kind of innate way to understand that there's certain questions to ask, there's certain things to say, but then there's also some things that you don't have to say anything at all, and the understanding's there. Yeah. And I think you're going to start seeing that more as you get more patients and people that have experienced something similar to you have. I bet you start getting a lot more people to that, and you'll start realizing like how powerful your story is, no matter what you're talking about, no matter who you're talking with, it's all relative to that person. So with me at that time, so going back to recovery process, I had 2.5 years of chemotherapy. And then at that point, I was actually diagnosed with a year in. That was when I had my first blood clots in my lung. So I had congestive heart failure. I had pneumonia, and I had congestive heart failure, pulmonary embolism, and pneumonia, all at the same diagnosis during chemotherapy. So that was the first heart failure that I had because of the chemotherapy. So the chemotherapy was doing a lot more damage than I had originally thought. And then at that time, that's right around when I was 19 turning 20, I moved out to San Diego when I was turning 21. So that was when I was in like full on recovery. Like chemo was at the end. It was a lot. It was called a maintenance stage. So it was not as intense of treatments, but they were still pretty, it's chemotherapy. It sucks no matter what. But yeah, so like getting to that point, once I moved out here, that was when my recovery started. And I started really finding being outside and being active and always having somewhere to go. And like snow not being a reason to keep me inside, and bad weather not a reason to keep me inside. Like, it kept me out, and I would do whatever I can to be outside. And I think that was a massive amount, not necessarily specific training, but I think the lifestyle of going from a New York City to a place as tropical and as outside and as active as San Diego and Southern California, for that matter, was a massive part of my recovery. Even to this minute, it's like there's never a time of the year that I can't go on a ride. Like, even if it rains or it's cold, it's not New York at that time of the year. So I'm riding. Yeah. I'm going outside. I'm going for hikes. Like, it's good. But then, yeah. So then that was fast forward. That was when I started planning my first ride across the country. It was for my 6 years cancer free. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to just reconnect with my oncologist that had saved my life 6 years before. And I rode from San Diego to New York. It was 3,168 miles in 38 days. And that was 6 years after my last chemotherapy. So that's when I got bit by the bike bug. And now it's over. Ever since that ride, it's been over since.
So did you start riding before that? Or were you like, hey, I'm going to ride across the country, and then you picked up a bike and went and did it? Because I've heard of people kind of doing it both ways.
I mean, so for me, I fully atrophied. So that's a good question. So like, I lost every muscle in my body in terms of like strength. So I had to rebuild functional strength. And so I was able to work with one of my friends at the time. He had opened up like a recovery studio, he was an anatomy major at, I think it was USD. Guy's an absolute genius in terms of like how to functionally improve. You know, the whole concept of mobility and flexibility is how you get to power and strength. And that's how I would, you know, really focus on all functional movements, all, you know, working on single leg, you know, squats, body weight, like everything I could do with the body weight that I had was how, from that point forward, that I've started working on my recovery. Because it's like, I lost muscle that I had for 18 years. I need to get just my walking upstairs with no, you know, without losing my breath, with being able to, you know, walk my dog at the time without being pulled down the entire block. Like, it's not just being able to ride a bike, but at that time I was riding a bike for commuting. So I was riding to and from work with the bike. I wasn't doing it for training at all. But that was when I started getting a little bit more serious, when I had my friend train me and prepare me for that first ride. He really worked on getting my functional training. He's like, because you're going to be gaining a lot of strength on the ride, a lot of endurance on the ride. So he kind of let the ride be where I built my endurance. And that was where I did. I started my longest ride ever was 45 miles before that ride. Day one was 65, day two was 80. And then my claim to fame, I did 700 miles in 7 days from Albuquerque to Amarillo. And I did, I'm a part of the 7-time Century Club member from that ride. I haven't done it since. But I had 700 miles in 7 days, and that's where I'm like, I think I could do this cycling thing.
Oh man, that is so insane. I actually had no idea that you rode across the country. I mean, were your friends and family just terrified for you stepping into this?
Oh yeah.
I mean, yeah, because I've noticed with my parents, my wife's parents, my wife's and that side of the family, because of my brother-in-law, they've had a couple years of very traumatic child things.
Stress.
Part of me is like, gosh, we got to give them a break. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, is your mom looking at you like, dude, listen, like we just got you healthy? Or was she like, hey, I know you're doing this for a greater purpose?
You know, that's a really good question. I mean, I've been very lucky. My parents have always trusted my judgments. And I think they've also gotten to the point where they realize that with all that I've been through, that I was finally in a position to make my own decisions and be responsible for that. And like, I've made it very clear to them ever since I started, you know, riding on main roads and freeways and riding across the country on two separate occasions and now going for the third. Like, I told them, I'm like, you know, if I could choose a way to die, like, I would rather be on my bike than anything else. Because it's like, I know that risk. I know that, you know, that if I ever get in a situation where I get hit by a truck going 75 miles an hour, there's a very good chance I never felt it in the first place. And when you've been through cancer and when you've been through stuff that I have, you get to the point where you just don't fear death. And once you do fear and you do spend a little bit more time thinking about things that you're afraid of, I think it affects your performance and your ability to really confidently do what you're going to be doing. So I've gotten to the point when it comes to riding, you know, in cities and streets and, you know, going on freeways that there's a chance, and I'm not against that. Not that I'm against it, but I'm not going to have that prevent me because of all that I've been able to get through of something that I never asked for in the first place.
You know what's crazy? And this is probably going to surprise you after what I just went through. I didn't even ask that question with cars in mind. I literally just asked it as far as your physical body holding up.
Oh yeah. part I wasn't worried about.
That is kind of funny though, the perspective of it, because I was talking to a buddy and I have the room to say this now after what I've been through, honest, before this, I liked riding through traffic. Yeah. I thought it was fun. I used to commute on a little single speed with like skinny bars and I was ripping through traffic. And even the thing about my experience is that I got hit on quiet country roads. Like it wasn't busy and people go to these roads to get away from cars. So that's what's interesting is like, people are like, how is it out being with cars? And I'm like, there are moments I notice through intersections. I actually almost feel it driving more than anything. But I think because it wasn't a highly trafficked area where it happened to me, it's like, it hasn't changed that much.
Right.
And I don't know. There's something like even when you said riding a freeway, you know, I rode a freeway for the first time last year in my Everest roam and dude, it was a blast. I mean, there's something exhilarating about it.
Totally.
Where dude, you do have a semi come by you and you're like, yo, that was crazy. And I was on and off. I wasn't going across.
You're feeling what power feels like. It's so insane how much energy they bring with them as they pass you, and you don't even like, you feel when they pass you barely. And you feel that tailwind that pulls you all over the place. That's the part that I'm like, this is rad. And I'll do it again, and I will continue doing it. But now, you know, whatever. Dude, we're crazy cyclists, man. That's okay.
yeah, for real. That's so awesome though. So was your heart transplant after this ride? Like how recent was the heart transplant?
Yeah. Great question. So the first ride was in 2012. That was the first ride from San Diego to New York. The second ride that I did was in 2019, which was a year after I received the heart transplant. So the year after, that one was specifically for me to connect with my heart donor's family. And so I was able to get in touch. Well, his family reached out to me pretty soon after I received the heart, which is not very common among that process. They typically tell you to wait about 6 months just to give the family, because there's a lot of circumstances that could happen and you want to give them as much time as possible. But it seemed like they had closure, that they wanted to make sure that they could connect with the recipients of their loved one. And I was able to connect with James's family very, very soon after I actually left the hospital. And from that point on, I had made it very clear, once I knew I had to have a heart transplant in the first place, that I wanted to connect with the family if I was able to. And if I wasn't able to, I would just simply, like, I would send them cards. I'd send them some level of, like, correspondence to just let them know that I'm, you know, I'm the one with their son or daughter's heart. And I am, this is my intentions. This is what I'm aiming to do with my health. You know, now that I'm finally able to be healthy as an adult, I want to do what I can with it. So when I decided to ride across the country, I wanted to ride to where he was buried, and I didn't know if his family would be okay with it, but he was in the military. So I was able to find out where he was actually located, at what burial site. And so if they didn't want to meet up, I was still able to ride to the cemetery and pay my respects, which was originally my plan. But I was able to meet his mom, his stepsisters, his stepdad, his grandparents, his uncles, his aunts. I mean, it was one of the most incredible things that I've ever experienced outside of getting the heart itself.
Oh my gosh, dude, I should have left more time for this podcast. we have more time.
We could do another time too, man. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, I have nothing but, I mean, look, I'm not in a rush. Whatever you want to do, we can do a part two if you want. Like, there's a lot of stuff here, man. There's a lot of stuff here.
Yeah. Yeah, this is incredible, and you really tell the story so well, because I want to obviously get into your training, but I'm like, I can't skip over the fact that you received a donor heart and you were basically at one point told that you need a new heart. And so why did you need a new heart? And
yeah.
And like, what was the process of basically finding that out and then finding a donor?
Yeah. So the way it works, it's very unique. It's not a common thing. And that's where I want to keep on having these conversations, because I hate to say it, but people in our world, in the endurance and the active community, like, we're prime candidates for people in this position, right? So if anybody were to have heart failure, you would want to have the heart of someone that could run marathons. You want to have a heart that could ride hundreds of miles. You want to have someone that's been fit, because that means the person receiving that person's heart, or even the organ or anything, that's going to allow that recipient to be more able to be active because of the condition of that heart coming in. Wow. So just to kind of give you a summary, like, so as a cancer patient, I had chemotherapy. Chemotherapy is full on toxicity. It's toxic. Like, as you know, with your brother, I'm sure his treatments were terrible. Just chemotherapy is not made to be fun. And so for me at the time, it wasn't a very targeted therapy. So it was more like napalm. They throw it in your body and they hope that it attacks what they're hoping it attacks. But at the same time, when it does kill the cancer, it does kill the cancers. It does kill the healthy cells too. So for me, what ended up happening was the 2.5 years of chemotherapy created this condition called cardiomyopathy, which is just a very gradual just failure of the heart. So my heart was getting weaker and weaker because of how much damage the chemotherapy did to the heart. And so what happened was, at 32, I had a heart attack. The heart attack was a golf ball size clot, which I'll send you photos if you want. Like, I mean, there's a lot, which I could give you a lot to play with in terms of, you know, of content and things to just kind of display this whole thing. But it was a golf size clot that was in my left ventricle of my heart. So that pump, that clot had to be removed, and they put this pump because my heart wasn't strong enough to pump by itself. That clot made my heart output less than 10%, where normal people are at least 25, 30%. So where normal people get heart attacks and they blow up because they eat too much, or they're, you know, really bad, you know, saturated fat, and like they literally have two, you know, their blood pressure is insane. Mine was slowing to a halt. It was so weakened because of the chemo that it was I was in constant risk of stroke because of the amount of, you know, pieces that could come off of that clot that was in my heart. And the left ventricle goes up to my brain. So I was in stroke watch until that clot was out of my body. So when they took the clot out of the body, that was when they put that pump in that I had to wrap myself with. So that was the bridge to allow me to become eligible to be listed for a heart transplant. So that pump was to be a temporary solution until I would be listed for a transplant. And that's what eventually ended up happening, was that pump that was in me had a failure. So I had a choice to be to receive another pump, and then eventually having to get listed for a heart, or I would put myself to be listed for a heart then, and then just go pat, like not have to have another pump installed, just get a new heart. And hopefully that would be, I wouldn't have to deal with anything anymore forever, or at least for a short time. So that's where 6 months after receiving my, so 6 months after having the heart attack, the pump failed, and that was when I got listed for the heart transplant. And I got the heart transplant because James, my heart donor, was a U.S. Navy flight surgeon, and he had an accident on Camp Pendleton, and he checked that box when he was younger when he got his license to be an organ donor. So as a result, because of the accident that he had, out of all the organs that he could donate, he was able to donate 11 of his organs. So I was the one to receive his heart.
Well, it's just, it's incredible that you not only had this available to you with this family, I'm sure the family, well, gosh, I can't even assume how they felt through the process, but you got to think that you riding across the country to basically honor James and to show the family that you are active, that you care about your life, that you are pursuing really positive things and growth physically, mentally, all those things that must have been very heartwarming for them to be like, wow, you know, this is going to somebody who is really going to make the most of it. I think that's what I'm trying to say. It's like, yeah, this is going to someone that we're very happy. This is the person who's receiving this.
You know, I mean, I wish we had a lot more time in terms of like segments and you know, maybe even have access to Christine, but the family that I ended up acquiring because of this experience is, I mean, now that you're aware of this type of story and that this is how it happens, you're probably going to be more cognizant to be like, huh, like the transplant story, let me listen to that, let me watch that. But let me tell you, man, I've talked to many of my nurses. I've talked to many of my people in my world, in the transplant community. And they say one of the reasons, which it's hard to say scientifically because there's no way to prove it, but one of the reasons why you're doing so well is because you've been able to connect with his family. I know his mom. I mean, there's times when I'm riding past. So like, you know, I live pretty close to Camp Pendleton. So when I drive up to LA, I'm passing Pendleton every time. And so every time I pass Pendleton, because that's where this whole accident happened, that's where he was stationed, I feel like a fluttering in my body. Whenever I see a photo of his mom, I get tears to my eyes. Yeah. So, I mean, there's like, he is still alive inside me in terms of his heart. Like my brain might be my brain, but the way I like to say it is like, it's the perfect team. Like we're literally a team internally.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some crazy stuff to be said. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like certain things, like I'm a very spiritual person. I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. And I am so wholeheartedly into that. Like to not be able to answer something, I love that because I kind of feel like that's James. There's some things that I see to myself. I'm like, I have that guardian angel. Like when I ask myself a question, I can be like, what do you think? And I'm going to have two disparaging, you know, words and different suggestions, but who's going to tell me that I'm just insane or that it's actually happening?
Yeah. That is so true. Like, and that's one thing I've mentioned through a couple of times is that I'm not going to have the disclaimer when I tell somebody that they need to step it up and work harder. Because as a trainer, your job is to tell people.
You only have so much you could actually push someone realistically.
Yeah, you got to kick them in the butt a little bit here and there. And so, yeah, I don't have to be tiptoeing around my words quite as much. But at the same time, it's like I have this layer of empathy that I've never had before. And it's a really interesting mix of these new personality traits.
Dude, it's going to make you a better athlete, because what you're going to start doing is you're going to start being able to pace yourself to a certain extent that you might not have been able to do before. But in that pace, you have the power you need to be able to get to that next level, but it'll be subtle. So meaning like it'll be confidence knowing that you have what you need to do. Like you need to flip a sprint. You're going to snap it on when you need to. But you don't need to right away. It creates a certain level of confidence. Like I would say, like when you have when you've experienced pain that you have, when you've had uncertainty that you've had, when you've, you know, and when I say uncertainty, like having a broken bone, having surgery is uncertain. That's not normal. Having a external piece of hardware being put into your body that stays there, that's not normal. So like to me, like if you are able to get past such an experience, anybody, you're going to have this internal confidence to say, I have titanium in my leg. Why would I not figure out how to optimize this possible, like this extra, let's call it this extra secret weapon or this internal like place you could put yourself when you need to put yourself there, because it's been worse. Mm. You've been on that stretcher. You've been in that hospital. You've been unconscious when you're like, what's going to happen now? You can think back to even the glimpse of that experience. You're like, I'm standing on the beginning of a race. I'm standing at the beginning of an event, and it's up to me how well I'm going to do. If someone crashes in front of me, hopefully they're okay. I know I'm going to be okay. You know, it's all accepting of the circumstance in front of you and learning how to use that as like your own internal, like, bro, I got this. Like there's nothing that you could do or say that'll prevent me from getting to where I need to be or where I want to be. That's it. But it's hard to explain it to someone who's never been through a part of their life that has happened that hasn't been their choice.
Yeah, that's a good way to say it, because it's not just saying like something traumatic, but even
it's something.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, that is really well said. Well, now you're in a position where what it seems like is you have some more choices, especially compared to those times, and you're doing this monster ride October 1st. Can you give me the lowdown on this ride as the basically the celebration of your 20th year since you got diagnosed? Yeah. I said that really weird. I said celebration.
No, it's absolutely celebration. I'm alive, man. Okay. 20 years. No.
There we go. Sure. Okay.
No, you got it. No, so it's starting. We're going to be starting in Jacksonville, leaving James's burial site at the Jacksonville National Cemetery. And then from there, there's a trail system. It's called the East Coast Greenway. And there's a parallel entry point to it. It's a little bit more east going towards the coast, but the entire route I'm going to be taking along the East Coast, it's going to be a designated trail system, no motorized vehicles, no cars, only bikes, only human powered vehicles and bikes, and I'm sure e-bikes, I'm sure motorcycles go on it, but you can't have cars on it. You can't have trucks on it. There's not a lot of massive amounts of traffic, which is good. It's not like a fenced off situation. It's just a designated part of that road in each of these locations throughout this route. The entire distance is 1,659 miles. I plan on doing it in about 22 days, about 75 miles a day. The max amount of climbing, and I'm saying this with confidence, is that all my training is going to be climbing right now, but the ride itself is 800 feet of climbing total for the entire ride. So I plan on, you know, going as much as I possibly can per day, because my last ride, I had more restrictions in terms of like a very strict schedule of when I had to take medications and stuff. Now that I've been a couple years down the road and I have my medication schedule completely figured out, I have more leniency of like when I could start, when I could eat, when I can't eat, because before I was not able to start eating until after 11 o'clock, and we would ride after 11 o'clock every day, which is very difficult, you know, when it's getting darker, it's October, you know, you know, the sun starts going down a little bit, you know, earlier and earlier every day. But now I'll be able to start riding at 7 o'clock in the morning. So I could be finished by 2 o'clock and then have a really cool rad camping session and, you know, barbecuing and, you know, just really experiencing that route going all the way up to New York City.
So that ride, the over 1,000 miles, you're climbing 800 feet
total, the entire route.
It's hard to believe that's even possible.
I know. I cannot wait.
Yeah.
I'm not a climber at all. I'm built like a third baseman, but like I am, like when it comes to descending and when it comes to flats, like that is my strength. And I mean, I feel very confidently I could do no less than 55 to 75 miles a day with, you know, by that time I'll definitely be ready for it. Cause I'm going to be just climbing all day long from now to then. So just to over prepare myself in a functional sense to where my strength is there. I want to lift, but I'm also kind of concerned with lifting, which we'll obviously go into. I actually have to go soon, go back to work real soon.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that real quick. So
yeah,
it sounds to me like you have a really good grasp on riding because you've been across the country numerous times. Mm-hmm. But you're concerned about adding in some strength training. Have you done any strength training in the past?
Yeah. Like I was here last year.
Okay.
Last year I was regularly going to the gym. Some mom stuff, some family stuff, as I mentioned, kind of came in to kind of take a lot of my spare time off. So that was where I just started spending more time on the bike, less time in the gym, but I'm familiar with strength training. I am.
And what's your biggest concern right now for adding it back in?
I would say it's just a matter of time. Just the amount of time I have post work. And then on the weekends, but then I would say, I don't compete, so I'm not too concerned about overtraining, but I think it's just maybe my default. Like the other day when I went on one of my routine rides, I felt like strength was there, but my bike strength wasn't. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense. So like I didn't feel so comfortable on the bike initially, but then I felt better actually as I was riding. But that was just the first thing that I saw was I just didn't feel confident in my strength bike wise, but I felt fine on the parts that I would normally struggle on, but my functional strength and my strength was actually there, which was actually interesting to me. But I'm open.
Well,
but I'm open to improving no matter what. So that's why I like with this conversation and your guidance, I'm much more into it than if I was doing it by myself.
Yeah, for sure. And I think this could be a good way to kind of wrap it up for you is just to give you my 2 cents on it.
Yeah, please.
I think that you want to look at strength training as something more than just getting stronger.
Right.
Physically, building muscle, breaking down the tissue, doing something that requires a lot of strain or something that's time consuming. Because one thing I've really tried hard to do over the last couple of years is really define that minimum dose.
Okay.
And that might be something that you want to implement to start with to really break down that barrier. Because even if you don't improve your max strength, you could still improve your neuromuscular connections, which is going to help you feel more functional on the bike.
100%.
And it'll also help you be more efficient in regards to what muscles you're using when. And you'll be able to control your what muscles are turning on and off, what's relaxed, when they can be relaxed. And we can also build up your muscular endurance, your stability, your mobility. Those are all things that help your durability. And with the ride that you have upcoming, I think durability is probably going to be one of the most important things.
Totally.
So my recommendation would be to use something like the 30-day no equipment bodyweight program I have.
Okay.
And then from there, there's a summer maintenance program that just uses a band, but it doesn't really increase the load. It just increases the variety and the complexity. So you'll have even more stability work. It'll be more advanced, but not more straining.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah. Count me in.
That was easy. That was really easy. But that's all I've got to say is that,
let's do it.
You know, 30 minutes twice a week, you get your mobility, your core, and your strength work done at the same time.
Absolutely.
And just take the focus off of maximum strength and feeling like you need to go, you know, deadlift hundreds of pounds and realize that there's all these other benefits to strength training that are kind of overlooked by that you can implement in a really time efficient manner and something that'd be realistic. So I'm going to get you set up on that. It'd be great to just start easy and then really not change much with your riding outside of what you already had planned.
Okay.
And we'll just sprinkle this little bit of mobility and strength on top.
Totally.
And you know, hopefully nail this ride. But dude, I'm really stoked. Thank you so much for sharing that story. It's crazy inspiring for me. Gives me a ton of perspective. And I know it will for the audience as well. So
appreciate it.
You know, we'll be following along. And Mike, what I'm going to do is add a link to the content you did with the feed that gives people a real overview of what we just talked about in like a minute. It's an amazing video. And that's actually what led me to reach out to you.
Thank you.
Then we ended up meeting at Sea Otter. And now we're doing this.
I'll
leave that in the link in the description below, along with your Instagram profile. Is there anything else you want people turned on to as to where they could follow you?
Instagram is going to be the best source to directly reach out. I have my website with just a bunch of links. It's MrMikeCohen.com. That's just going to be like links to previous rides, previous photos, previous interviews. I'm going to be starting to sell some merch to help fund the ride. So there's a link on there if you want to buy some stickers. But I'm going to start really putting more vlogging and just more engagement from now until really throughout the ride, you know, via vlog, YouTube. I'm going to try to hit all the different media vehicles to share this story and inspire as many people as I can.
All right. We're going to be following every step of the way. Thanks a lot, bro.
Appreciate it, man. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dialed Health Podcast. If you found it inspiring, if you feel like it's motivating you, helping you become the healthiest, most dialed version of yourself, please leave this thing a review, 5 stars on Apple or Spotify, and just write anything positive about the podcast. I really do appreciate it. And until next time, start moving forward.